So the denial everybody's hand went up when we started, so I think maybe we'll start at the very beginning. Can we toss out a quick definition of perhaps what genre is? Aaron, do you want to take that?
Well, basically genre is a marketing category. And so, you know, science fiction, fantasy, horror, literature, all of these are kind of marketing categories, and something can be in more than one of those categories if you start looking at what the content of the story is. So the defining the boundaries of particular genres is a very difficult exercise.
It's one of those things that Eric's right on instinct. He's spot on marketing because mainly publishers have to sell it and bookstores have to shelf it somewhere. For the record, I am considered an urban fantasy author. I'm considered a very successful urban fantasy author. I hate the term urban fantasy. I write about people in rural Alabama, but it's urban fantasy. So you're going to get shoehorned into different things even if it doesn't necessarily fit. For example, and also this is helpful when you guys are pitching stuff to agents and pitching stuff to publishers. They're going to want to be able to put it clearly in a genre bucket. So when I went with my second series to my publisher and I said, well, it's an alternate history epic fantasy, but it's noir pulp 1930s gangster stuff, but with ninjas and magic samurai. Oh yeah, there's a big complicated magic system too. Well, I've been calling them space aliens. So that's why we have genre categories.
I think there are pretty clear lines that you can say characters like this or situations like this are standard to certain genres or move across all the genres. But I mean, if you've got a guy with a ray gun, you're generally going to think that's sci-fi. If you've got a guy with a sword and a furry diaper, he's a barbarian from a fantasy story. And so I think we all naturally realize what goes where generally. Unless it's, you know, gangsters in the 20s and space aliens and whatnot. Like, but there's so many things that don't fit easily. I mean, is Princess Bride, either the book or the movie, a fantasy or is it a comedy? Is it a romance or is it an adventure? And when you blend that kind of stuff together, those lines, it's really easy to lose them.
Something Orson Scott Card on defining the difference between science fiction and fantasy said it's very easy. Science fiction has rivets on the cover and fantasy has trees.
Well, it's everything's already been said. Basically, you've got with broad category genre, everybody recognizes, you know, the Western, the romance, you know, that sort of thing. And then we start to shape it. And what would a shape it? There's a little off here. This kind of fantasy. You know, high fantasy. This kind of has nothing to do with the drug culture. And then it's, you know, this kind of fantasy, you know, that kind. And we start slicing layers because it doesn't quite fit with the general touchstones of fantasy. It's too unlike Tolkien or Eddings or any of the grandfathers of the genre. And it really is, it's like when you go to school and they teach you history, and then you go out and you're actually reading history. And you realize that in school they prepackaged it so it would be easier for them to grade. That's all it is. It's easy to shelf it when you can say, oh, this is this kind of thing. Now that we don't shelf things anymore, when Barnes & Noble finally dies, I wonder if it will be as important.
No wish for that. You're making a lot of money on Barnes & Noble.
I'm not wishing for it. I'm predicting it. There's a difference.
Fingers crossed.
Sorry. No. There's a medical emergency in case you can tell us I'm not letting anybody in the building.
Well,
I was talking
to
other people that
didn't
allow me. Cyrus read the 2014.
Wait, go past
the
medical emergency
firm.
Patient zero is among us.
I don't know. They had several ambulances outside, and I saw an EMT come in with a stretcher.
It's like ER means Comic-Con.
Yeah.
That's definitely.
I guess
you're
wondering if people are
taking care of them. This poor EMT is, oh, damn, another zombie
cosplayer. So, I'm really sorry to come late and do this. I'm Penny, I'm Harrison, I write the Rose Room, mostly young adults, romance slash fantasy. I have some nonfiction stuff that are just ebooks online. 21 Reasons You Think You Don't Have Reasons for You Think You Don't Have Time to Write. It's free on Amazon right now. And I'm also a super competitive triathlete, and I just came up from physio today. With some hardware. Yeah, I put my arm on my hammer, and I put my finisher's medal, and I just...
If I remember correctly, what your program says that this is actually about, I think it says something in there about when not to blend genres.
Yeah.
So, how, why, when, and not to? Let's get the really hard one out of the way first. And let's start with when not.
And you're passing it right to me. When not to. I'm not sure I can think of a good reason to set up a bunch of rules about not to. I mean, my initial response is to say, well, maybe you need to know the genres pretty well before you start messing around in the rules. But on the other hand, I've seen people who were brand new, who came in and gave a fresh spin to the genre that really needed something new. Still, for the rest of us, I still recommend it, knowing what the rules are before you start messing around with them.
I can only think of one reason not to blend genres, and that is if you have to force it. If you're like, these things don't go together and they're not going together organically in my story, but I'm going to force it because I have a cool idea that this will be a neat thing, well, you just shoot yourself in the head. You know, it's, if you can't make it work, your reader can't make it work either.
I think if, for instance, you've been invited to participate in an anthology that is looking for a specific type of story, don't try to give them the kind of thing they're not looking for by blending genres when that's not what they want.
I'm going to say in your own personal stuff that there's not really any reason. if it's awesome and people like it, then you get rid of it. If it sucks and it's lame and people don't like it, you can't. So don't try to force it. Just tell the best story you can. And if that takes you across genre boundaries, awesome. And then the hard part is the farther out you range, the harder it's going to become for you to sell it. That's the challenge.
I think you can come up, I think right off the bat, I could say, you know, don't mix a children's book with Hunter S. Thompson-style gonzo journalism. But, like, you know, you think about that and break that down and go, wait a second, that we couldn't necessarily take that off the table, because what if it's a student journalist? And what if instead of drugs, he's high on candy? You know, like, and just take it down to the level where your audience would accept it. I think you could probably make just about anything work. Yeah. Well, I mean, they've got children's. I bought one for my daughter, a children's book. It's an alphabet book full of all the Cthulhu monsters. And you don't think that would work? My next book is a children's illustrated history of presidential assassination. You know, I think you can make anything work if you pay it the right respect, know the rules of the genre, and respect the audience and the reader to give them what they're going to expect, and turn that enough on its ear so that it's not tired.
I was going to add to what I said before also that condescension is going to be something that you should never, if you're going to use a genre, give it respect and don't. So, like with children's writing, for instance, I see a lot of adult writers who are trying to write in YA or middle grade because they believe there's a lot of money to be made there and they think it's easy. But if you read some of the books, I'm not going to say all of them because some are very well done, but some of those books, there's this condescending attitude towards children. But I've seen that same condescending attitude towards vampire novels. Like, if you don't care for vampires, that's fine. Don't go write a vampire novel, like, condescending to everybody who likes vampire novels and expect them to like it.
See, I told you that was the hard question. You didn't get a single you shouldn't answer without the caveat, you know, unless you can't do it well. I told you it was the hard answer. All right, let's go on the flip side of that and come with another hard answer, or another one hard to answer. If we take out the idea of writing for a specific anthology where the editor specifically wants something, you know, we want to do exactly this to hit this niche market, without that as an answer, does anybody have a reason when you should? I do it nonstop. I'm all about it. I think genre is an artificial construct. It exists primarily for marketing reasons, and marketing reasons and storytelling reasons are, you know, they're mutually exclusive. My job is, I'm an entertainer, so my job is to tell the most entertaining story I possibly can. If that means blurring the lines because I want to do something interesting, because I want to bring in intergalactic space menace into this, or if I want to bring in borderline slapstick comedy into a serious action thing and it works, by golly, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it as well as I can. I'm going to go wherever I think makes the most awesome story. So I'm all in favor of it. I think as time goes on, and it's like Dan said, wishing for the death of brick and mortar bookstores. I know.
We heard you. It's recorded. You wish for it.
But as time goes on and more people expand their buying choices in books, and there's more and more choices in entertainment, then it's going to expand outward, and it's going to be more and more new things. I mean, there's whole new micro genres pop up every day, and I see sometimes that I get stuck in these micro genres that I didn't know exist. I was like, ooh, Larry Crew is one of the leading lights in diesel punk. What the crap is diesel punk? It was like steampunk that moved up to like 1930s with fedoras. And so, weird little things. I mean, so basically there's these little micro genres that people make up, which is funny because even once they make up the micro genre, people already broken that one. You know, steampunk didn't exist as a genre 20 years ago. You know, you'd say steampunk, what? It's gears. It's like gears and brass. But these things pop up and they come and they go, and just tell the best story you can and don't worry about chasing the money.
I think as writers, we all ask ourselves, like, what if? What if this character was here and what if this character was there? And sometimes those are really easy fish out of water stories. You know, what if that barbarian was in the future? Or what if, you know, there was a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court? You know, and so we like blending that. I mean, in my last book, it was a World War II soldier is sent back in time, and he ends up in the late Jurassic, and he finds an entire community of time travelers from different eras, and really that's different genres. There's somebody from a sci-fi timeline, there's somebody from a steampunk timeline, you know, there's like an 1800s inventor. And throwing people from a whole bunch of different genres and saying, like, what if they're time travelers? What if they're stuck in the late Jurassic? What if the Nazis show up? Playing with how each of these people would react to that. You know, the people from the future are like, the Nazis haven't been the bad guy in 500 years. And the guy from the past is like, what's a Nazi? Like, I don't even get it. And playing with that is so fun. And I think that's why we do it, is to see what happens to the rules when we move them elsewhere and see how far we can go without breaking them so far to the point where the reader just checks out. I write steampunk westerns, so that's my book of Flux Engines is a steampunk western. People are like, why did you write a western? Because steampunk was screaming for a western. And just, for me, that went together perfectly, you know? Cowboys and six shooters and airships. I just love the idea, so I wrote it, and hey, it was a good story, and that's what I made a book out of it. That's gotta be your guiding light, is would I want to read this? And this is awesome, yeah. And I think Larry's absolutely right. You're talking about artificial constructs. Cross those lines anytime you can, as long as it's you having fun and doing what you like to do as a writer. The only caution, really, is you do have to sell these ideas. And sometimes an editor might give you the hairy eyeball on some of this stuff. But then you just pitch it a little differently.
Well, part of it depends on how far you are in your career, too, in your
contacts in the industry and stuff, because I suck at pitching. I have never in my life sold a book based upon a pitch. So, but at this point, my publisher trusts me enough that if I say, I want to write a book about this bizarre, you know, space penguins from beyond across the Thunderdome and a children's story of the carrier, she'd be like, all right, here's a contract. because I've built up that relationship of trust with my, yeah, that's the next thing. That and sexy mummies are the next big thing. But if you, so basically when you're starting out, I'm going to kill you for funny. But the thing is, when you're first starting out and you're trying to sell a book, that's really what it moves you to stick into something that's a little more marketable. Once you have a name and you have a little more liberty of what you can and can't get away with, it's going to be an easier sell for the crazier ideas, you know?
As an example of how this works in terms of trying to sell a novel, my agent is currently shopping around a novel I wrote that one editor described as a science fiction thriller with superhero overtones. But in order to try to market it to thriller editors, he wanted me to take out one little thing. I referenced that, you know, there are supersonic passenger jets in the course of this story, because in my mind it's taking place, you know, 15, 20 years in the future. And he said he wanted me to take that out. He didn't mind that there was a supersonic spy plane. He didn't mind quantum supercomputers, but the everyday detail of supersonic passenger jets he wanted out of there, because he felt that made it science fiction rather than a thriller that could be taking place today. And so sometimes you need to try not to violate people's genre expectations. I mean, I've still got the superhero overtones in this science fiction thriller, but he wanted to tone down just one little particular thing.
You may not have noticed, but I am not Larry Correa, and I cannot sell any book that pops into my head. I actually have to get not only an editor who likes the story, at least the story idea, some proposal of some kind, but I also have to get a marketing team on board. And let me tell you that my experience so far with marketing teams has been they like to have a genre category because they want to know what place it fits in the bookstore. And even if you don't have brick and mortar bookstores, Amazon also wants to know what category your book fits into. So it's really, I think genre categories are useful to a certain extent. And I'm going to give just a quick example. I hope this doesn't sound self-serving. When I wrote The Princess and the Bear, the sequel to my book, The Princess and the Hound, I pitched it to my editor, and I said, look, some of the characters from the first book time travel back 100 years, and they changed the past. And she's like, no, we're not doing time travel in a young adult romance fantasy. That's never going to work. But that was the idea that I had for the book. And I wrote it, and she told me, you've got to keep the characters from the original book. We need to know what happens to them. We need to, see some progress in their lives. Even though, for me, the book was not about the original characters in the book. It was about a different set of characters. And so I sent her this book that had this frame story about the original characters, and then the central story was still the time travel. And she read the novel, and she said, okay, I like it, but let's take out the frame story, which in fact she told me to put in the first place. But the key here was that even though I used this device of time travel in what was otherwise a romance fantasy, it was still a romance fantasy. Does that make sense to make this sort of distinction that there's a difference between blending genres so much that nobody can tell what genre it isn't anymore, and using bits and pieces of other kinds of genres, and yet making it, still having to be clear what genre your book remains a part of. I mean, I'm not saying that one of those is better than the other, but one of them is easier for somebody like me to sell.
Well, a lot of times when somebody comes up, I was in my booth, or Tracy Dixon's booth, actually, and people come, what's your book about? Well, it's Steve Western. Okay, that communicates. That has information that a potential reader needs to know. And it's a very convenient and prepackaged way to communicate. It isn't all that this book is. There's a romance plot in there, and there's a bunch of other things. But it's a very easy way that everybody kind of has a shared consciousness. Oh, this is a science fiction story. I can expect spaceships, laser guns, and intergalactic fun and games of some kind.
Just you on that for those of you trying to sell books, come up with a real quick, pithy, like one line pitch about what your book is, because that way when you are talking to an editor, you are talking to an agent, then in a conversation at a con like this, they say, what's your book about? Like, so if I'm talking about Lost Runners, I would say it's X-Files meets the Expendables. Is it really? No, but it's close enough to make it a picture. Or, you know, Grimoire is Great Depression Superheroes. Okay? It's just enough for them to collect it, so come up with something pithy for what you're trying to sell, and that'll really help you.
Well, and you need to look at, sometimes when editors are rejecting your book, it's not because your book is bad, it's because they can't put it on that shelf easily. My first book, I got lots of rejections for it because they didn't know where to put it on a shelf at all, and I didn't realize this, I just kept sending it to people. And I had Mike Stackpole, who wrote the X-Men books, take a look at it, and he's like, yeah, no one's buying it because they have no idea where the hell to put it. And so he was the one who was like, just put this one out yourself. You're going to conventions. It was about a gonzo journalist going to a convention. And he's like, you're going to conventions all the time anyway. You can sell it there. There's your audience. You don't need to worry about where it fits in on a bookshelf. And I sold tons of copies of it, but it was that nudge from someone saying, like, it's not going to fit over here. But if I were later in my career or something and said, hey, I want to do this now, you know, 10 years from now, I probably could get somebody to take it and cram it on a shelf where it doesn't belong anyway.
Yeah.
I don't remember if I said this when I introduced myself, because after a while panels start to blend together, I'm sorry. I kind of write all over the place. I, you know, if a story grabs me, that's what I write. I don't really like to depend into a genre. But I think you can tell by listening to all of us, we all genre blend. You can out of time. I recently had my writers group read one of my stories, and they all looked at me and like, where did this come from? You wrote a non-genre piece, and that's not in you. That's a really hard concept to grasp. Anybody have thoughts on how to wrap your head around it when somebody says, oh, you wrote a non-genre piece? What does non-genre mean to you guys?
Lit-tech? Yeah, no, I've got a book, I've got a manuscript that I've been tinkering with for years, and it's completely literary. There's no genre in it. It's, you know, coming-of-age story, a couple of teenagers. It's like, and I show it to people, and they're always scratching their heads. And it's because I think we all have all kinds of different stories we want to tell. Every book I've written, every short story I've written is 180 degrees different than the last one. And that's just how my mind works. Like, I'm interested in everything, and so I want to write about everything. And usually it's, like, genre kind of stuff. It's usually, like, sci-fi fantasy or horror, or I call it geek fiction, actually, because I think that's, like, more of a mainstream catch-all for all that kind of stuff. And you hand them something really literary, and they're kind of scratching their heads. But that's okay, because I like surprising people.
I think sometimes we use genre as a code for science fiction and fantasy and horror, maybe.
Mystery,
yeah. And if it doesn't fit into, I think we sometimes use it as a shortcut to mean just this our particular set of genres, and when it can mean other sorts of genres as well. And I think that's where confusion comes in sometimes when you say something is non-genre. That's saying it's not in our particular genre, but it's in a genre, a different genre.
Well, the cool thing about being, if you're a literary writer and you're published in the most prestigious of all literary journals, you'll be read by literally tens of people. If you include the editorial staff of the prestigious literary journal. So unless you're literary and you show up on like the Oprah Book Club, most literary writers, and I think you guys might back me up on this, but most people who are considered literary writers are actually college professors who they make their living as a college professor or a lecturer, and then they turn out a book every 7 years.
But then you've got guys like Michael Shannon.
Yeah, there are some. Like I said, once again, you hit the Oprah Book Club level. I mean, come on, over a plunger hot dog stand, you're making $1 million. Okay, so.
I have talked before on a different panel about how much I admire J.K. Rowling, for different reasons. One is that I feel like she did such a great job of refusing to be pressured to finish faster than she needed to be finished. But more recently, I have been absolutely blown away by her ability to completely write, to write something completely different and do it superbly. I don't know how many of you have read her book, The Casual Vacancy, which is in the literary lit-fit genre, and her latest book, The Cuckoo's Calling, which was sort of outed, it was published under the Robert Geffen.
One quick note on that, because I also have a lot of respect for J.K. Rowling, I really do, except she's the only thing standing between me and number one was that she revealed, that she was Robert Galbraith the week my book came out. And so I got the numbers, and I was number two, and I was like, wait, who's number one? Robert Galbraith. Who the crap is Robert Galbraith? I went to the bookstore, and I go to the bookstore, and I'm like, who's Robert Galbraith? We're going to display in front, sir. And it's like 16 feet tall, and it's a pyramid, and it's like J.K. Rowling's doing it.
Have you read this?
No, I'm sure it's great.
It's amazing. It's not just. Good.
Maybe you were number two this morning, right? You were in your triathlon. Wouldn't you have liked him at number one?
the person who was number one was 23, and I'm 43.
Well, number one was J.K. Rowling.
I'm really sorry. It's hard to see. I think that she's teaching people a lesson about how flexible writers really are. And I will say, I've certainly read books by writers who were trying to do a different genre than they were well known for, and they failed miserably. Like, I have seen that happen. But I love that she had the courage to publish her book under a pseudonym. And if you read it, I would never have guessed that it was Rowling. I would have bet my life that it was a man, and that he had been he'd had war experience. Just there's so many details, and kudos to her for doing the research. And I think, to me, it's a lesson in not letting people tell me what little category I fit into, and also a lesson in, boy, you better do your research. Just make sure that if you are going to write something really different, make sure you do it superbly well.
I think that actually kind of speaks to, like, we all have all kinds of different stuff swimming around in our brains, and you never know what's going to come out when you sit down at a typewriter, or I guess people write on computers and stuff, too. I write on a typewriter a lot.
You've just lost half the audience.
Okay, a typewriter is the same thing. You insert paper. And you, okay, so we're good. Yeah. I've got brass and rivets on it. But the idea is that we are not, I mean, like, I couldn't point at someone and say, this is the only genre you're going to like. You know, so why would you expect a writer to produce in just that one area?
But we do like comfort as readers. I mean, I'm speaking as a reader. As a reader, when I go to a bookstore, I do tend to look in certain places, depending on how I feel. Sometimes I'm in a mood and I want a romantic comedy, and sometimes I'm in the mood that I want a mystery. Sometimes I'm in the mood for an epic fantasy. And I actually want to be able to go and find books that fit the mood that I am in. Most readers are like that. Not that they have to read only the same genre all the time, but that they may be upset if you fool them. If they were in the mood for something and you gave them something that they didn't want.
That is something to watch out for.
David Weber, one of the most successful science fiction authors of all time, okay? David Weber recently did a book called Into the Dark for Tor, and it was a straight-up sci-fi, no SF, because he's known for Arne Arrington, and people bought that expecting David Weber, no SF, and all of a sudden Dracula shows up during a space invasion, an alien invasion, and vampires defeat the space aliens. And it's like his poorest reviewed book ever, because what happened is people came in, I haven't read it, so I don't know if it's good or not, but people came in expecting one thing, and they got something different. and really torqued off a lot of readers. So that's another thing to think about for genre mixing.
Titles and covers, which you don't always have control over, or sometimes you don't, but I never have control over my cover. But covers do indicate to your reader the genre of your book and the style and, you know, various things. And if they feel fooled, I have a book that I think has a fabulous cover, but it's a steamy romantic cover, and the book itself is actually funny, light romantic comedy, and I think I've had a lot of readers who were unhappy because they wanted steamy romance, and they picked up a book that was light and funny, and they're like, but these characters are laughing about stuff. Well, yes, they are.
Okay, I'm going to open it up for questions here in just a second, but before I do, I wanted to say, is there anything somebody wanted to say we have not said? Excellent. We're going to open it up for questions. I am going to lay down some rules. Everything must end in a question mark. Most of the people here are here to hear what these people have to say, not what you have to say. Don't give us a thesis. Ask a question. I hear you're hurt.
Yeah. What you're talking about, being inside editors, agents, publishers, and talking just about readers, how do you blend them in a way that hooks readers and attracts them?
As I mentioned, I'm running a book series with Tracy Hickman, and when we can pitch this to people, we have said it's called Dragons of the Confederacy. And everybody goes, oh, I get that. That's cool. And anybody go, well, what's that about? If you genre bend, you got to put it up where your readers can understand what it is, especially before they lay down $15 for your book. And so, Scott, you've got to have your genre bending either on your cover, in your title, or in your border.
Really good example of that. One of the most successful books ever is Guns of the South by Harry Turtledove. And that cover of Robert E. Lee standing there with an AK-47 has to be, because it's, all of a sudden you see Robert E. Lee, and you got Robert E. Lee with his modern weapon. You're like, whoa, that cover has sold more books than anything.
Now you know what
books are. I think one of the other things is giving them enough of what they expect without paying attention too much to one genre or another. I was working with an editor on a space western, because space westerns are cool, and I was really paying attention way too much to the western tropes instead of the sci-fi tropes, and my character didn't actually have any communication device. You know, he didn't have any way of finding out things in the next town or even things like that, and I'd written it in such a way where that almost seemed like a hole to someone reading science fiction and said, well, how do these people communicate? These guys crossed space. Why doesn't he have a cell phone? You know, like, these are the sorts of questions. And I went through and I had to rewrite that book just about from page one with just that one suggestion where it is a Western, but I had to come up with ways to give him a little bit more technology than I had to meet the expectation of a reader who is going to say, like, well, I've got a cell phone. What's wrong with this guy? You know? So you have to pay attention to what people expect of each of the genres and respect the setting you've created.
In case I didn't quite answer your question, first, let me say, if you're serious about being a writer and you don't have a writer's group, you need one. Look into that. If you write your story, you have what you want, if you can't figure out how to pitch it, take it to your writer's group, get somebody else's eyes on it, they will be able to tell you what it is.
How do you know if your characters are like
16
to
20
years old and wonder whether you're writing a young adult or an adult novel?
How do you know? We have a new slice of that genre pie for you called college fiction.
New adult.
They call new adult fiction, but new adult, that's less descriptive. I don't like it. But that's okay. I don't make the rules. I just follow them when I choose to. But yeah, they're slicing that pie too. So there's a category for that.
I think that young adult, and I'm gonna jump in because I feel like I have expertise in the young adult genre. I think young adult has very, very distinct rules. And the best way to figure out if you're writing young adult is to read a lot of young adult fiction and see whether it fits that category. But be careful. Number one, I said this before: don't condescend to young adult. Your young adult characters need to be grounded, and the situations that they are in, I would say, don't pull punches. But also, there are certain things, even though I say don't pull punches, there's a certain level of violence I think that you cannot do in the adult book. Strangely, there is, so far as I can tell, not a certain level of sex that you cannot do in young adult books. but
That depends on who you write for. The guys I wrote for, the rules, I wrote a lot of YA, and the rules were no sex, no gory violence. Anything else was okay.
Okay. If you want more information, because I could go on and on about it, and I don't want to derail the whole conversation, but I have a post online on my Tumblr that's called What is YA? And if you just Google my name, Betty Ivy Harrison, What is YA? That I've got like 20 different things that make a YA novel.
I think a lot of people here are here because they don't necessarily like the traditional, shelves or buckets that everybody puts everything in. I mean, personally, my book, they tried to say it was a YA, and it was something that I wrote with my 10-year-old in mind. I wanted to write a sci-fi book that I wouldn't feel bad handing him and wouldn't be too far over his head, that wouldn't condescend. So I wrote what I considered an all-ages sci-fi book, and I can hand it to my 10-year-old, and I can hand it to my peers, and everyone gets a level of enjoyment out of it. And so I've tried to really personally not fit into that beyond, like, no super gory violence, no graphic sex, no swearing, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's just me personally with the last couple of books I've written, but that's not always the case.
Let me just jump in one other thing about it's important if you're talking in the publishing industry and you are trying to pitch a book, you need to understand the distinction between young adult and middle grade. If you want your 10-year-old kid to read it, it's generally going to be considered a middle grade. Like Brandon Mole's Fable Haven books are what I would call all family reads for everybody. They're great for everybody. But that's called a middle grade in the publishing world. If you're trying to pitch to agents, young adult is like its own category and has its own thing and is not generally for like the whole family.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask why. So when you pitch it, you pitch it as an
all-ages book. Yeah. Question about research. Say you know you're writing a story about Confederacy and dragons. Would you say like research is more important when you're genre bending, or you think it's less important when you're building your own world?
Research is always important when you are writing, especially when you're writing books about things that really happened. If you're writing a book in a world that you made up about events that have no bearing on anything in reality, I don't know that you have to do that much research because you make all the rules. But there's still, I mean, I'll never forget the time my father called me after having watched a PBS show on the English longbow. And he was excited. He said, "Hey, my dad loved this stuff. You know how long a far longbow can shoot?" I said, "Yeah, about 300 yards." I said, "How do you know that?" "Yeah, this is why I do." You know? That's okay. There's certain things you just have to know because unless your gravity's different on your new world, your longbow's going to shoot about 300 yards.
I think the great thing about research is that it can give you stuff that you didn't realize you had to work with. I wrote a book that was sort of a steampunk World War I thing. In my head, it's just like, yeah, I know about World War I, and I'm gonna steampunk it up, and it's gonna be really cool. And I got to researching World War I for a few months, and I realized it was already steampunk. It's like I had to go so far as like I'm throwing in jetpacks and stuff like that to make it more out there than it was because it was already. I mean, like they had zeppelins, they had these really cool things called grasshoppers. With these giant like steel crossbows they shoot grenades with across the battlefield, like all this weird kind of stuff that I never even realized that I got into the research and was so excited about it that I could incorporate all of that stuff into the book, and I think it made the book richer, but it also forced me to stretch my imagination further than I realized I needed to.
I'm gonna say research is gonna be, he's exactly spot on. You're gonna pick up a lot of story elements, especially things you never thought of before, especially when you delve into actual people. Like I do a lot of alternate history stuff. The one caution I'll give you is don't research forever and hold off writing the book. Research is great and all, but you need to write the book. I see way too many people in alternate history who never actually get the book done because they're trying to get this absolute perfection knowledge of the time period. And the thing is, you're going to leave 95% of what you learn out of the book.
It's an alternate history.
It's
So we give you something wrong. Like I at one point in the psychic reading was I had Burma and Shade instead of Burma Cream because I just wrote the wrong word. That's not as an altered history.
But if you need to go to Paris to research, you know, World War I battle sites, feel that. That was great. Provided you finish the book.
If genre is a lot about labeling, how would you label a multi-genre, and would you reference it, like, if you just use a little bit of another genre, would you reference it in your genre?
You don't know. You actually, as a writer, you will not know until it shows up on Amazon, and it says, bestseller.